Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Face Connecticut on WTIC News Talk 1080, 96.5 TICFM, and Light 100.5 WRCH. Aaron Kupek with you this Sunday morning, and we're pleased to be joined by Lori Brown. She is Executive Director of the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters. Good morning to you, Lori.
Good morning, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
Tell us what the League of Conservation Voters does.
The League of Conservation Voters is a statewide nonprofit, and we're bipartisan. And what we do is we make sure that environmental issues are a top priority for our state elected leaders and lawmakers. And so we work with advocates and all the groups and the organizations that want to pass solid environmental policies at the state level. We work with all of those environmental leaders and those groups throughout the legislative session and throughout the year. And so we work on a range of issues, whether it's open space, clean water, clean air, sustainable transportation, clean energy, bonding, regulations, whatever it is that session that the groups are working on. We help identify the full agenda. And at the beginning of every session, we bring together in our annual environmental summit every January before session, we bring advocates, lawmakers, and members of the administration together to sort of talk about what are the big issues that need to be addressed this session. And each session we do that. So we all start out generally on the same page, understanding what's out there. We don't all agree on everything, but we absolutely know what's going to be before lawmakers and before the administration every year. So with that, we can identify and tee up for legislators what priorities they need to be paying attention to. And so that's how we get the information and get the information out to lawmakers and establish the agenda. But then we have to hold them accountable. So we also have what's called an environmental scorecard. And at the end of every session, we rate them. We rate lawmakers. We give them a score of 0 to 100%. And that's based on how many times they voted in a pro-environment way on a bill. Or they can vote against a bill and they would get marked down for that. So they get a score like 80% or 90% every session. And it's not just, it's kind of black and white, but it's the only tool of its kind really to be able to know how your lawmakers are doing on the environment. And if that's something that you care about, then that's also something that you can consider when you're casting your vote on election day. We also endorse candidates that are pro-environment candidates for public office from both sides of the aisle. And we do believe that, you know, environment is absolutely bipartisan. It should not be part of partisan bickering. And we really work very hard to make sure that lawmakers have every opportunity to do right by the environment. And I think our constituents, you know, all expect that from our leaders. So that's how we sort of enter the session.
So the session is over. This first special session is over. I understand there's a second one coming, but now it's time for the League and a lot of other groups to tally your wins, tally your losses, and the incompletes from the session. Tell us about some of your key wins this session.
This session was absolutely dominated by two big issue areas, and one of them is climate change, and the other had to do with waste and recycling management, waste management. So there were quite a few bills that would have done things that would have reduced emissions from vehicles, heavy trucks, increased electric vehicle sales. It would have codified the governor's executive order to have a zero emission electric grid. There were quite a few things that started out this and looked really promising at the beginning of session. On the waste side, there was a number of recommendations that had been put together by the Sustainable Materials Management. It was a Connecticut coalition of like 75 towns and the DEP that put together recommendations on how to deal with this crisis that we're having on waste management. Those recommendations involved like the bottle bill, which has not been modernized in 40 years. I mean, we have a recycling program in our state, which is a landmark bottle bill recycling program that is a deposit system. And it has not been modernized in decades. And it's been many, many years in the making to get modernized deposit amounts, handling fees. The expansion of the types of bottles and cans is very different now than what it was 40 years ago. So everything that changes, believe it or not, our recycling system has to be changed in statute by law, by lawmakers. It doesn't just sort of change itself. So the amount of the deposit, the amount that's paid for handling and recycling it, the types of bottles, right down to the fact that, you know, we didn't have all this teas and juices and carbonated beverages. We didn't have a lot of that back when the list was established. So the bottle bill was one of the centerpiece wins of what took place this session. So it now expands the types of containers. It increases the deposit from 5 to 10 cents, which we know based on where this works in many other states, our very, very low recycling rate is under 50% right now. And this in the first year or two is going to bump it up to 80%, 90%, because this just massively changes the whole dynamic around recycling. So that's a really big deal. The other thing on the important thing is that it increases the convenience for recycling. So it will require a lot more of the stores to have, the RVMs, the return vending machines, where you drop your bottle in the machine. But also it's going to increase what is called the handling fee. And so that will encourage and support opening many new independent redemption centers where you can bring entire, truckloads of recyclables. So that's a big deal. They did not do NIPS, those little miniature alcohol bottles. They've got to come back and do that. They put a fee on those. It's not a redemption fee, a redeemable amount. So we know that that doesn't help clean up the NIPS. But the other thing that they did not do was the liquor and wine. So again, these are things they're going to have to come back and work on more. But this was a huge step forward. And there's more to be designed in terms of the stewardship of this whole program. So we've got a lot of work on that. The other big win was PFAS. And if you remember PFAS, that is the chemical that's used in firefighting foam. And they had that huge spill back in 2019 in the summer. Of the firefighting foam into the Farmington River. It's hugely toxic, very bad for health, bad for drinking water. They're called the PFAS or the polyfluoroalkyls, and it's a class of chemical that is incredibly dangerous for your health and for the environment. And it's called a forever chemical because they are very difficult to get out of the environment. They accumulate in your body. They cause all kinds of health issues. And it's been a fight against really essentially the chemical industry, against the advocates. But when the legislature failed to deal with PFAS, it was only a few days prior to the big spill. So right before the legislature ended in 2019 and did not take up this same bill, the spill happened. And so since then, all kinds of things have been, kicked up a notch. And finally, after many, many years of working on this, the legislation went through that would ban it, the firefighting foam that's used for training. So that's a big deal. And it also bans it in consumer packaging, because PFAS is found in everything, in your cookware, in your clothing, in your children's toys, in fabrics, in cosmetics. It's everywhere, and it gets into your body, and you don't necessarily know it's there because it's not like a test that you run in a typical fashion, right? So everyone's wells, it turns out, just recently, people's wells and their water sources are seriously contaminated. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done to even assess how much is out there and how it's affecting, the public. But the bill that just passed deals with the consumer packaging issue and the firefighting foam issue. And so now the DEEP and, the DEEP, Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, and the Department of Public Health, they're now going to take the next steps to sort of figure out, okay, are they going to have to adjust the drinking water standards, for example? And so the next step beyond this then will probably be cosmetics or textiles. But this is a huge step in the right direction. So those are two really important wins.
Going back to the bottle bill, when do these changes take effect? Should I be stockpiling all my cans that are worth 5 cents now? Will they be worth 10 cents when this kicks in?
That's funny. No, they actually do phase. They're phasing in a way that, you know, this was all negotiations, last minute changes. And so some of the switching around might still need to be adjusted. But when you phase in the deposit versus phasing in expanding the numbers of you know, bottles and cans that are going to be redeemed, at what price? I have to go back and really kind of look again at the sequence, but it was very thoughtful in the way it got put in. No, you don't want to be hoarding. You don't want to be hoarding your bottles and cans. And the redemption centers are always, you know, open and have stayed open. They were considered to be priority, services that were required to stay open during the pandemic. They never closed, but the redemption centers, you know, that, I mean, the RVMs that are in like the grocery stores, and that was for a period of time closed. And that was a big deal, because when those closed, we never realized just how important they were for our waste stream and how much, you know, people really depended on those. And so we fought even harder to make sure that we had good modernization and the convenience factor, as well as an equity factor, in terms of how the language was written, so that we can make sure that if you're increasing the deposit from 5 to 10 cents, that will certainly bump up how much people recycle and actually not in the blue bin, but, you know, take it back and get their money back. But you need to make sure that there's easy places for lower income communities that are less served by these redemption centers. So people have to have the ease and ability to return the bottles to get their money back. And that was a big factor when this bill was designed. We wanted to be sure that it didn't inequitably, you know, raise the cost of beverages for lower income or underserved communities without increasing their ability to get that money back. So that was a big deal. There's also going to be a grant program for particular communities. Women and minorities will be able to access that to actually start their own businesses locally for redemption centers.
You are listening to Face Connecticut. We are talking to Lori Brown, Executive Director of the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters. Now, there's a pot of money. It's the difference between the deposit that's collected and the deposit that is returned to the consumer when they bring the bottle back, because not 100% of the bottles are going to get returned. What happens to that money now, and does this legislation change where that money goes?
Yes, it does. Yes, that was one of the things that, you know, industry had been fighting against the bottle bill, even modernizing it, and just wanted to do away with it because they were no longer, at one point, the state considered the unredeemed deposits as actual escheats. Unclaimed property are escheats. And so they went back to the state. And at that point, that's when the real battle sort of began with the industry and the wholesalers and retailers that were trying to basically get rid of our bottle bill altogether. And so what this does now, there's a split, like an 80-20 split, and that changes over time to where a percentage of it goes back to the manufacturer, wholesaler, and the other pieces of it can help pay for the grant programs and for other things that, you know, would help a recycling program be effective. And so those phase over time.
Now, on the issue of the NIPS, the little liquor bottles, that is a fee. Some will call it a tax. That is not a deposit. And proponents have said this is supposed to help clean up the NIPS that are littering our roadsides and other areas, but it sounds as if you might not be convinced that's going to help a lot.
Right. Well, the NIPS have been, interestingly enough, you know, that is something that has infuriated lawmakers to no end. And every time when we've been interviewing, you know, legislators, and talk about the bottle bill and recycling, they all get very animated when you talk about NIPS, because everybody sees them everywhere. They're a real problem. The litter and the cost of litter and getting those off the road, off the roadways, out of the parks, out of the ocean, that all falls on the municipalities. And so what they did was rather than do nothing on NIPS, they put that 5-cent fee, and that will go into a fund that then will be distributed to the towns to help them, you know, with certain conditions to do what they need to do to try to reduce the litter. Now, the position of the advocates is that, you know, that still is not the incentive that you need to have them stop being thrown out the car window, right? The only way you're going, I mean, you could eliminate the NIPS off the roads like overnight if you put a 5-cent deposit on those. I mean, it just didn't work out that way. Industry did not want it. And they, at the end of the day, the compromise was struck to get that 5-cent. So, yeah, we never had asked for that. And the same thing with the glass and, you know, the heavy glass, the wine and liquor definitely needs to be, you know, it has to be brought into the system because it's heavy, it's expensive, it breaks. And so the value of it goes down when it's just tossed into the recycling bin. And again, they were not able to work out the compromise on how to make that happen this time. So again, they've got to come back and fix these things and do some adjustments.
Another big topic this session was TCI, the Transportation Climate Initiative, which, the way I understand it, would have been a cap and trade program to raise money for environmental initiatives and cut down on pollution. Do I have that right?
It's actually a cap and invest, which is different. It's a cap and invest. And what this whole program has been designed over the last 10 years. There's been extensive modeling. It's not something that just got cooked up this year, I can tell you that. We are and have signed on to an MOU with Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and DC. So there are a number of other states that are trying to get along into this program. They're hovering and they've agreed to sort of work towards this, but Connecticut was one of the first to come out alongside, as I said, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and DC, our neighbors immediately. And we, between us, really produce something like 70% of the transportation emissions in our region. So the three of our states joining forces to reduce emissions through transportation initiatives is gigantic for climate change. So the fact that, you know, our leadership really did fail us on this front. I mean, the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, by not acting on this, it was a huge loss for climate, for health, for equity, and for our economy and jobs. I mean, the infrastructure that this thing would end up pushing and funding for green jobs and green sustainable infrastructure for transportation is, you know, a loss that is not going to go away. We're certainly not done. Just because they were not able to pass it during the regular session doesn't mean we're not going to get there. And, you know, the Rhode Island just passed it yesterday, and Massachusetts shows every sign of moving forward. So we really are, we need our lawmakers to get moving on this. And I think that now that TCI is not tangled up in budget negotiations, people are actually having a chance to look at it. And I think most people just did not understand how it worked. And lawmakers, for different reasons, had not really had an opportunity to sort of fully vet it or ask all the questions or find out what the actual on-the-ground benefits would be for their constituents in their districts. I mean, there's a lot of misinformation that the fossil fuel industry has been fighting. TCI has been publicly fighting these changes, but it's a market-based system that is going to incentivize reductions in emissions. And it has caps on it to keep the costs from being passed on entirely from, you know, fossil fuel industry that's making all this money and causing the pollution. To not just simply pass that cost along to the consumer. So the modeling around the finances for TCI has taken all that into account, consumer behavior, industry behavior, and has estimated that this would end up bringing in the first year, which would not start for about 2 years, in the first year in the order of $90 to $100 million, which then goes directly back into programs that would either, for example, anything that would benefit, there's something in it for everyone. I mean, if you're in a urban community that has high air pollution next to transit corridor, and your kids have the highest asthma rate in the nation, you know, in that area. This is, for example, could be matching funds to provide electric school buses, low emission school buses. If you're out in the rural area and you're heavily reliant on your car, but you're a senior and you don't drive anymore, you know, this could help fund like transit buses geared for seniors that don't have cars anymore. I mean, there's all kinds of things. If you're a commuter, this will help pay for improving mass transit. And, you know, then there's the pedestrians and the biking, bikeways and bike paths. There's just so many things for so many different interests in our state. So the whole goal is to cap emissions. I mean, that's what it's all about. And the difference between this and just a tax on gas is that this actually guarantees emissions to be reduced over time. And it puts the industry, gives them some skin in the game. So they now are incentivized to find ways to reduce their emissions. And they can do it. Technology's there. They can. There's all kinds of things they can do. So this incentivizes that. And the way it works is that they would have to buy allowances. So the fossil fuel, the folks benefiting from gas and oil production and sale, they would be helping to pay for the pollution that they're causing. And so they would have to buy allowances that would incentivize them to start reducing their pollution, because you have to buy the allowances to cover the amount of pollution that you would be causing. So all of this has been really modeled out. And I think, unfortunately, this became, you know, the hardline partisan battle, and it got tangled up in the budget. And so now that the budget is done, I think we're having people that are really interested in seeing this move forward in our state. Hey, you're going to be leaving a lot of money on the table. All of our neighboring states, all the ARPA money, all the matching funds that we need to come up with to tap into federal funds. And believe me, they need matching funds from our state. This provides that. So Connecticut would really lose out if we do not find a way to get in and continue our efforts to get the fully, you know, fully functioning TCI program up and running in our state as soon as possible. We don't have time to wait.
This was painted as a gas tax increase in disguise by opponents. What would it do to gasoline prices?
So that's part of the modeling. And the modeling takes into account that if all of the industry passed along the cost to the consumer, it would increase gas prices by approximately 5 cents. And it just fluctuated by that, you know, this past week. I mean, that's, you know, my gas in my car just went up 30 cents. So what you have is that, again, if you had a gas tax, all that does is take money from you. There's nothing that you get back for it. There's no investments and there's no programs. And there's certainly no incentive for the fossil fuel producers and sellers to reduce their emissions. So with the modeling that was shown, if they passed on that cost, it would likely be 5 cents within the normal range of variance. And there are cost containment provisions. So for example, if the modeling turns out to not be quite right or it goes up faster than thought, there's they could sell, for example, more allowances, which would keep it capped at 9 cents. So it would never go over the 9 cents. And again, both the emissions would go down over time. And so you would have fewer emissions, fewer allowances. And it's just a win-win for Connecticut.
She is Lori Brown, Executive Director of the Connecticut League of Conservation Voters. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. And if there's any information that people would like at ctlcb.org, you can find out more about all of the environmental bills that were on the table this year.
Thanks for listening to Face Connecticut. I'm Aaron Kupek. Enjoy the balance of your weekend.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.